Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends. Brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Dalila Harris. My debut novel, The Other Black Girl, was a New York Times bestseller and is available now in the US and in the UK.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television. New York Times, July 4th, 1985. The Reverend Dr. Polly Murray, a lawyer, writer, and civil rights activist who was considered the first Black woman ordained to the Episcopal priesthood, died of cancer Monday at her home in Pittsburgh. She was 74 years old. Dr. Murray became a priest in 1977 after her graduation from the General Theological Seminary in New York City. She served as a priest in the St. Stephen Incarnation Church and the Episcopal Church of the Atonement in Washington, the Holy Nativity Church in Baltimore, and the Holy Cross Church in Pittsburgh. She was also a poet and teacher. In 1940, Dr. Murray challenged segregation on an interstate bus in Petersburg, Virginia, and was jailed for several days. In the 1960s and 1970s, Dr. Murray served on the Civil and Political Rights Committee of the President's Commission on the Status of Women, as a member of the National Board of the American Civil Liberties Union, and a charter member of the Civil Rights Group of the National Organization for Women.
In 1933, graduate of Hunter College, Dr. Murray earned her law degree at Howard University in 1944 and a master's degree in law a year later at the University of California at Berkeley. 20 years later, she earned a doctorate of juridical science from the Yale Law School. Dr. Murray was admitted to the bar in California in 1945. The next year, she became a Deputy Attorney General of California. She was admitted to the bar in New York State in 1948. From 1956 to 1960, she was an associate attorney with the New York law firm of Paul, Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. In her final year with the firm, she was admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court. Among her books were States Laws on Race and Color, 1951, Proud Shoes in 1956, and The Constitution and Government of Ghana, 1961, of which she was co-author with Leslie Rubin. Dr. Murray had been the senior lecturer at the Ghana University Law School in Accra. She was also the author of a book of verse, Dark Testament and Other Poems, published in 1970. In this episode, we'll be discussing Polly Murray, who, as you heard in her obituary just now, was an incredibly important and accomplished activist and writer, even though most of us know little to nothing about her. In Proud Shoes, the story of an American family, which is about her maternal grandparents, she wrote, "True emancipation lies in the acceptance of the whole past, in deriving strength from all my roots, and facing up to the degradation, as well as the dignity of my ancestors," which we'll hear Barbara speak on a little bit more later on in the podcast.
In her memoir, Song in a Weary Throat, which was published posthumously, she wrote, "And while I could not always suppress the violent thoughts that raged inside me, I would nevertheless dedicate my life to seeking alternatives to physical violence and would wrestle continually with the problem of transforming psychic violence into creative energy." Explaining the title of the book, she wrote the book's oft-quoted line, "Hope is a song in a weary throat." Her legal arguments and writings, meanwhile, helped to advance public school desegregation, women's rights in the workplace, and an extension of rights to LGBTQ plus people based on Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Our guest on today's episode, Barbara Lau, is the executive director of the Polly Murray Center for History and Social Justice. Barbara connects her commitment to justice with her belief in the power of community practice through her work as the lead developer of the Polly Murray Center for History and Social Justice. Barbara's 20 years of experience as a folklorist, curator, professor, media producer, and author include curating the exhibition Polly Murray, Imp, Crusader, Dude, Priest, producing To Buy the Sun, an original play about Polly Murray, co-directing the Face Up, Telling Stories of Community Life Community Mural Project, and teaching documentary courses about Durham history and culture. And I think we need to start out by just acknowledging that both of us were like, we do not know who Polly Murray is. So if you do not either, dear listener, you are not alone.
Yeah, you are definitely not alone. As I'll say later on in this podcast, I don't pride myself on knowing everything about Black history, but I do like to feel like I know a lot. And I remember when I learned about Bayard Rustin and had a similar feeling while reading about Polly Murray, of the sense of like, why didn't I learn about this person in high school? Especially given the fact that a lot of Polly Murray's work went into Brown versus Board, which is huge.
This is so weird, and the reason she probably isn't known is exactly because of all the things that make her so special. It's because of her, you know, genderqueerness and her work on behalf of women and her Blackness and her work on behalf, like all of those things probably came together to basically erase her, because it's like more strikes against her. But it's also just like, I don't know, it almost makes you wonder. It's like, did she do too many things? And so she couldn't be like the one person on this, you know, the person on this thing. And I'm not saying we shouldn't all go out and try to solve all the world's problems, but I wonder if she had a branding problem too, that like, you know, she didn't, if people like you to stay in your lane and
right.
one thing and be that this Rosa Parks of this, you know, that one thing. And she did Rosa Parks move too, and didn't get any credit for it among her. And it's just, if you read about this woman, it's like one sentence after the other about her accomplishments, or just like, stop, it's too much. And we don't know anything about her. Why?
Yes. And highly recommend, listeners, if you want to know more. I mean, there's a documentary coming out in October that we'll be talking about in this episode, but also check out Song in a Weary Throat, her memoir. It's really inspiring how many different things she was involved in, as Jennifer just saying, but how dedicated she was to every single thing. I have so much respect and so much admiration for her. And I feel like we can learn so much from the way that she literally had so many doors slammed in her face, was told no so many times, but still continued to pursue equal rights. So many different things that are so important and are the reason why we are here. So all of us are here having these conversations, especially speaking about trans rights and what that means in the US today. And throughout this podcast, we will be referring to Polly sometimes by she and sometimes by they, per Barbara Lau, who is, as we mentioned, the executive director of the Polly Murray Center. In the documentary, I believe Polly's family also refers to her as she, and some research does, and some research refers to her as they. I'm not sure if that has to do with, you know, not wanting to necessarily put her into our time today, because it is a little more complicated, I think, than what it might be.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, we just don't know what she would have preferred given the options that we have now, but she, you know, it's like, we read her obituary. It went with she because it was of its time, and she referred to her own he/she personality. And so, you know, it's impossible for her to, you know, choose her own pronouns now. So we have to go with kind of what she was stuck with to a large extent, or you can go with they and not pick a side.
Yes. Yes. But we wanted to make sure everyone was aware of that as we go into our episode about Polly Murray.
So to start things off, we are going to have our guest actually read a selection from Polly Murray's work so that you can get a sense of it, because a lot of us have not had the pleasure of encountering her that much or at all in our reading lives.
Excellent. Well, this is one of my favorite poems by Pauli Murray. It's called Prophecy. It was written in Cambridge in 1969. I sing of a new American, separate from all others, yet enlarged and diminished by all others. I am the child of kings and serfs, freemen and slaves, having neither superiors nor inferiors, progeny of all colors, all cultures, all systems, all beliefs. I have been enslaved, yet my spirit is unbound. I've been cast aside, but I sparkle in the darkness. I have been slain, but live on in the rivers of history. I see no conquest, no wealth, no power, no revenge. I seek only discovery of the illimitable heights and depths of my own being.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's
perfect. Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for joining us for Dead Writer Drama. We are so excited to be chatting with you today.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for the invitations.
Of course. So our very first question starts at the beginning of Pauli Murray's life. So we know, of course, that Pauli Murray had a particularly tumultuous childhood. She lost her mom suddenly when she was a young child due to a brain hemorrhage, and her father was beaten by a white guard after being committed to an insane asylum a few years later, after her mom passed. So can you talk a little bit about just how the things she experienced as a young person contributed to who she became later on in life as an activist and just as someone moving through the world?
It's my pleasure to share some of this story because this is what connects Pauli Murray to Durham, North Carolina. Pauli was one of six children, but the only one of the children of Agnes and Will that came to live with their grandparents, Robert and Cornelia Fitzgerald in Durham. And I believe this is elemental to the person that Pauli became later. These are two very powerful personalities, very principled people who shaped Pauli's outlook on the world. So Robert, as a Civil War veteran, talks about duty and giving back and the power of the vote, the power of learning, left Delaware to come to North Carolina after serving in the war to be a teacher, which was not a profession, unfortunately, that came with a big salary. So had to do multiple other kinds of jobs and work in the community and then managed somehow, and I've always wanted to see this letter, to convince his entire family, his white mother, his African-American father, and all of his brothers and sisters to move to North Carolina in the 1870s. I mean, who's heard of that, right? But you can tell that he had a powerful point of view, a powerful view of the world, and the potential of African-Americans who were educated to be active citizens and to shape the future, moving toward equality. And then Pauli's grandmother, Cornelia, was a devout Episcopalian, a woman of great faith, who had a very different experience, was born into slavery, but raised by her white aunt and baptized at the local Episcopal church. But again, just this really strong personality with ideas about the way the world should be and what did it mean to be a good person. So here comes little Pauli, right? 3 or 4 years old, by herself in a household full of adults. Both of Pauli's aunts that helped to raise Pauli were teachers. So education was super important, reading, but thinking about the way that it impacted current events. One of Pauli's jobs was to read the paper to their grandfather. So these ideals, this kind of commitment, this kind of vision for a better world, these are the things I think really shaped Pauli as a young person and put Pauli on the path toward becoming the justice champion, the educator, the voice of a new vision for the way that the world could be.
Thank you for that. And I also remember really being taken with the fact that Pauli also I mean, her family, there are darker skinned people, right? And also lighter skinned. And I remember reading, I believe in her memoir, she said something like, when we all get together, it's like great nations or something like that, where it's just like a lot of different kinds of people. And I imagine that must have also really impacted her growing up as a young person in the US at that time. That feels like that would be so rare to see.
Absolutely. In fact, Aunt Pauline Fitzgerald Dame, who became Polly's mother, was someone who was so light-skinned that could have easily passed the color line and was married to an attorney for a number of years, also of very light skin, who did choose that and said, Pauline, you're my wife. Will you come with me in this choice? Pauline said, nope, I'm going back home. I'm very proud of who I am. I have a choice about where I'm putting my energy and what I believe in, and chose to identify as African-American, as Black. And in that family grouping, so Robert's brother, Richard, also moved to North Carolina and became an incredibly successful business person. And he and his wife had 12 children. So there were a lot of Fitzgeralds kind of in Durham in this one neighborhood, the West End neighborhood at the time. And I think that they're in terms of the way they presented their skin color was widely across the spectrum. And Polly was a very smart young person. So this is something Polly noticed. How did people react to people who were perceived differently? How was darker skin perhaps how that made life a little bit more difficult? Polly was getting older as the Jim Crow laws were really being reinstituted, and was even as a child quite defiant. Not going to ride the bus because I sit in the back. I'll walk to high school across town. I'm not going to, you know, because being raised by such proud people, was not really willing to, when they had a choice, put themselves in a situation where they were being demeaned because of the way that they were perceived based on the color of their skin and their race. But clearly saw that the inequity in the schools, the kind of school Polly went to in an elementary school, the kind of schools that the white kids went to, the kind of books they had, how cold was it in the winter, you know, all those kinds of things. What kind of houses do people live in? Durham was a very small city at that time. Durham didn't exist before the Civil War. So in those decades leading up to the turn of the century, Durham was in massive growth. But you could live very close to other people, Black neighborhoods that were pocket neighborhoods surrounded by white neighborhoods, other Black neighborhoods that were much larger, that were literally, of course, on the other side of the railroad tracks or south of downtown. Polly was very perceptive about that. And even the topography. Of course, the people with money lived on higher ground. And before you had sewers, before we had modern medicine, this protected your health. Whereas in Polly's neighborhood in the West End, there was a whole section of it referred to as the bottoms, where there were creeks running through. And because, of course, there wasn't a sewage system, people would, you know, throw their refuse and their trash into the creeks. And that created opportunities for more illness and that kind of thing. Polly really could see those invisible boundaries, as it were, pretty well, even as a child.
Thank you. And, you know, that kind of leads into another question. We had a different question for you next, but Jennifer, if you don't mind me dodging from the script, because you mentioned Jim Crow. And one of our questions for you, Barbara, was, of course, Polly referred to Jane Crow, her term for intersectionality, 40 years before the term was coined, and even longer before it became a mainstream talking point. So how did intersectionality affect her attitudes and her work in the arenas of civil rights and feminism?
You know, that's a great question. And one of the things that's so powerful about Polly Murray's life is that these observations, like the coining of the term Jane Crow, grew from Polly's personal experience. Being at Howard Law School, feeling in Washington, D.C., the discrimination based on Polly's race, and then being discriminated against because being perceived as a woman, you know, identified as female. And so I love that Polly would just make it up when there wasn't words to explain it. And I think that's actually a hugely powerful lesson for the next generation and all of us.
Yes.
When you don't have the words to describe it, don't doubt the experience, doubt the words, make up the words, find the way to describe what's really happening. And so I do think that the confidence that grew from growing up with those people who loved you so deeply, who believed in you, who invested in you, for who you saw yourself as the next generation of their ideals and voices, that gave Polly a kind of confidence to self-validate those experiences and to think outside of the way everyone was thinking. And again, I think that the overlapping identities that Polly held as a person of color, as a female identified person by society, as a queer person, as a person who grew up without a huge economic advantage, those actually gave Polly the platform for insights. Mm-hmm. So in some way, while we often think about multiple discrimination as a negative or just a, you know, like the layers of, you know, heavy blankets, in some ways, they're also the avenues of new thought, right? So when you don't have to be like everyone else, you can have different ideas that are, in this case, Jane Crow, a precursor to intersectionality, really powerful, as was Polly wrote to their aunt as a young person referring to their he-she personality, right? Mm-hmm. Did not have language for gender nonconformity, but wore their hair very short, preferred to wear pants, chose at times to dress as a young man to while traveling or where that would create safety or just because that was more comfortable, did the things even as a young child that boys did, you know, paper route, no cooking, chopping wood, you know, this kind of thing. But Polly didn't have the language of gender nonconformity. So what I appreciate is that these ideas, one, were very connected to lived experience, and two, grew out of the permission to validate that experience by putting it into words, by developing the concepts, and by looking for the connections. So one of the things that Ruth Bader Ginsburg credits Polly as doing is taking some of the legal reasoning that had been used so effectively by civil rights attorneys to fight for rights based on race and applied that to rights that should be based on gender, arguing that you can no more change your race than you can change your gender. Now, you know, our ideas about that have evolved, but that thinking is what then underwrites some of the strategies that Ruth Bader Ginsburg credits Polly with as what some scholars have called Polly the mother of the feminist legal strategy. So again, not being confined by the boxes, right, being able to say, no, this is my experience. You can't tell me this isn't what happening, what's happening. It also opens doors sometimes to really innovative and brilliant new thinking. So I think that's something that some of the scholars have begun to open up. And I think that's a really powerful way to think about people who maybe don't fit in the box. Yeah.
Speaking of that, she was many firsts, including the first Black person to earn a JSD, which is the Doctor of Science of Law degree from Yale Law School. What was her relationship to education? It seems like, especially during that certain time in her life, education was a huge place where she was constantly kind of pushing those boundaries.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Coming from the South with only 11 grades of high school education, Polly had to get another high school degree before being able to apply to college, goes to college, and then realizes a few years later, obviously graduates into the Great Depression, jobs are really tight. So realizes a few years later that additional education might make for more possibilities. Thinking about policy, thinking about being on the front lines, thinking about, yeah, bringing these great ideas into the public realm, and tries to do that. Polly tries to go to UNC to a graduate program in sociology in 1938, is refused because of her race, and later on is offered a scholarship to attend Howard Law School, goes to law school, graduates top of her class, which comes with a fellowship to do additional study, or the LLM degree, applies to Harvard, is refused from Harvard because of her gender, writes this great letter saying, "Gentlemen, if I knew the way to change my gender, I would. But since I can't, or this hasn't been shown to me, perhaps you could just change your rule." You know, they obviously don't respond, and goes to California, to University of California, where Pauli gets involved in immigration rights and people coming back, Japanese Americans coming back from relocation camps. But I think that what's interesting here is all along in this point, you see Pauli's writing, it's all focused on sort of the public realm of changing policy and changing the laws. Pauli actually ran for city council in New York City. You know, so there's this effort to think about being a public person, being a public leader, being somebody who's interested in policy and change making at that level. In 1960s, after the 1964 and 5 Civil Rights Act, the government develops the Office of Economic Opportunity. And Pauli gets the contract to be the legal counsel of that office, works for 8 months in that role, and then the permanent job comes open. So Pauli has applied for the permanent job, which requires a list of every address you've lived at, you know, multiple references, you know, all this material. And in fact, in Pauli's FBI file, there's a memo that says, "We have to find a way not to give this job to Pauli Murray. The reasons have to do with political associations, gender nonconformity, sexuality, these kinds of things." And this is humiliating. This is something Pauli has fought for. This is a role in which Pauli could have been that kind of public policy enforcement that was going to change so much about gender and employment. So Pauli has to go back into the office, get all the stuff out of their desk. They offer Pauli the deputy's job. Of course, Pauli says, "Goodbye." And this is when Pauli's, I think there's a major shift. Pauli turns to higher education. So works at Benedict College, you know, and chooses to get involved in higher education through, you know, having already received their JSD degree and then going on to being a professor. And so it's you see these big shifts of like, well, how do I solve these problems? Oh, I'm going to try it this way. I'm going to be an activist. I'm going to try to challenge the laws. Oh, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to do this. Oh, I'm going to, you know, work in Ghana. I'm going to write books. I'm going to do research. Oh, I'm going to try to impact policy. I'm going to try to make that difference. Oh, now I'm going into education. And then, of course, finally, in the 1970s, saying, you know, these issues I've been fighting all my life, these are moral issues. What does moral leadership look like? And choosing to go into faith leadership. So that the goal, the big, here's what I want to do, here's what I hope my life will, what impact my life will have, that doesn't change. The strategy, the avenue, the profession, that is a longer journey and a more winding journey. Obviously, so Pauli ends up having to get 2 divinity degrees as well, because the Episcopal Church doesn't change its policy quickly enough. And so when you add them all up, it's a huge number of post-secondary educational degrees. I mean, Pauli was highly educated, an incredible researcher and writer, an excellent teacher, all those things. But you just see that there's these multiple avenues to get to the same place. And I always refer to that as the world that Pauli dreamed of, the world in which a Pauli Murray could fully show up, could be valued, validated, who could reach potential, who could make the contributions that I think Pauli knew were possible. So it is a lesson. I refer to Pauli's life in some way as a witness or a lesson about activism. It's like, oh, the strategy doesn't work. Here, we're going to pivot. We're going to try this. We're going to try this because we have our eyes set on what we think is possible.
And Pauli did, just listening to you talk and all of the things I've learned. I mean, full disclaimer, and we'll say this at the top of the podcast, but like, I had never heard of Polly Murray and I'm embarrassed. I'm not someone who's up on everything all the time, but I hadn't heard of her. And I've talked to other people who are also pretty up on, you know, civil rights activists, people, especially Black history, and also drawing blanks. And it's really fascinating why that is. And we'll talk a little bit about it today, but just curious, can you, for readers who might not know who Polly Murray was, can you give them a sense of where Polly was overlooked? Because there are some pretty glaring places, a lot of places where she was overlooked, but then also where Polly was given at least a little bit of the credit she deserved?
Yeah, I think I refer to that as episodic validation and something I was just writing.
Yeah.
There are many places in 20th century history where Polly Murray's contributions are not held up, are not given a lot of amplification or great light. There's a great historian named Susan Ware who said that when historians look back at 20th century America, all roads will lead to Polly Murray.
Wow.
Civil rights, sexuality, activism, you know, all of these places where Polly's life overlaps with the nexus of these very important changes. And when you think about people who are born in that decade of 1910, there's some amazing human beings that entered our world at that time. I think that for many reasons, Polly's sexuality, Polly's unwillingness to conform to other people's strategies. When we think about women who are at least somewhat known in the civil rights movement, and many of us have trouble naming five women who were very instrumental, and we know there were hundreds. You see the sexism of that movement that promoted male leadership, promoted a particular sort of archetype of a leader. Polly didn't fit that.
Right.
Polly wasn't willing to do what they told her to do. Polly tried to mount a campaign after being refused admission at the University of North Carolina and tried to involve the NAACP and was not deemed the perfect defendant in the case. There were already rumors about Polly's sexuality. Later on in the women's movement, Polly was not really well heard, despite being one of the founders of the National Organization for Women, in part because Polly was trying to call that movement closer to the needs of women of color and working class women. But at the other hand, in the 1940s, Polly was listed in Mademoiselle magazine as one of the young women lawyers to watch, right? Polly's poetry was lifted up by numbers of people, Lillian Smith in the South and others, at times when it just really gave voice to what many people were thinking. And I think that the fact that Polly Murray's historical memoir, Proud Shoes, The Story of an American Family, was published in 1956, is an amazing feat. For many of us, the idea of African-American genealogy was far from mainstream. It did not really become more mainstream until the Roots series on television in the 1970s, at which point they republished the book. But being ahead of your time, being someone who Eleanor Holmes Norton said that Polly pulled history along with her, being on the edge of that wave, there are many people that serve those roles that are not as well known as the people who came into the spaces that were created by those forerunners and were viewed in more public ways. I think that just in general in the 20th century, women were not lifted up into public view, were not considered the voice of authority, there are very few exceptions to that, maybe Eleanor Roosevelt, who was a friend of Polly's, but, you know, the research from the 20th century about even how people responded to male versus female voices on the radio, which was a primary avenue for sharing information and sharing literature and sharing, you know, radio dramas, all those kind of things. You know, it wasn't women's voices that were reading the news. It wasn't women's voices that were speaking to you from the White House. So I think that those kinds of things really kept a person like Pauli Murray a little bit more in the shadows. Now, there were certainly people around Pauli that understood the value of what they were bringing, and we're seeing that more, right? So Ruth Bader Ginsburg is saying, in the 1970s, when I was going to the Supreme Court, I put Pauli's name on the brief because I was standing on Pauli's shoulders. And there's even a story that when they were making the documentary or the film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, actually the fictional film, that in reading the first draft of the script, she said, if you don't include Pauli Murray and Dorothy Kenyon, you're really not doing your job here. This is to her nephew, who was the screenwriter. So I think there were people, there were some people who really knew about the value of Pauli's work, whether it be with tenant farmers or with, you know, legal scholars, or if you ever have a chance to read some of Pauli's sermons, they are powerful pieces of literature. And I can only imagine what they, some of them would have been like to actually hear. I think that, you know, that's, so some of that's just the circumstances of being a person who thinks ahead of many other people. Lots of people have that experience when you're quicker than other folks in the room or in the conversation. It's hard. You want to just keep going, and it's hard to, you know, bring everyone along with you. And I think Pauli had that kind of energy and that kind of foresight. And I'm sure that that was a challenge for a lot of their life. But, you know, I'm just glad that here we are. Pauli died in 1985. Here we are decades later. Two of Pauli's major books have been republished, in one in 2016, one in 2018. We're getting ready to welcome a brand new documentary film that will be distributed around the world. There's more and more people who are discovering Pauli Murray, and maybe that's the way it should be, because we're finally catching up to those ideas. We might not have been ready for some of that forward thinking in the past. And I think that because Pauli's now experiencing a little bit more of a quote unquote mainstream, let's read that, more white folks are reading Pauli, because I think there were definitely more Black folks that knew about Pauli during their life, that, you know, that those ideas can be even more amplified. Right? They can open more doors. Because of course, the question is, oh, if I didn't know about Pauli Murray, who else was I missing? Who else is out there? And who are the Pauli Murrays of today? The ones that are pushing the ideas we're not really ready for. They were like, I don't know if I can go there. Is that too fast? Is that too this? You know, that was what was happening, I think, with Pauli Murray in their lifetime. And so part of that invites us to think, well, can I soften those boundaries and listen more to the things that feel too much, too fast, too far?
Yeah, you mentioned the documentary, My Name is Pauli Murray, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and it will be coming to Amazon Prime in October. And in 2017, even, Catherine Schultz wrote an extensive and eye-opening profile of her, which I was just, every sentence, my jaw was dropping again, because I couldn't believe all the things this woman had done for The New Yorker. What do you think is sort of happening now that is making us maybe finally embrace Pauli and get to a point where maybe more people will know about her?
And I also want to add to that. I mean, I should say I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and so was also extra surprised I hadn't heard of Pauli. At the time, the big thing was talking about Zora Neale Hurston's presence on campus, which was often overshadowed by other things. And so now, recently, I think last year, Hamilton Hall, which is the sociology hall, is renamed for Pauli Murray. And I've had a couple classes there. So, I mean, North Carolina, very different from The New Yorker. But it's also cool to see that they were like, you know, UNC, that was a crossroad. That was a time when we could have done something different. And now we are acknowledging that. And this is named after her rather than a white supremacist professor. So that's great. But yeah, so many changes happening.
Yeah, they are trying to get that name change through. Of course, the Board of Trustees is standing a little bit in the way of many name changes on campus. So,
it's not official because it's not official. The website it says
unofficial. Hmm. They hung the sign out the window, but they haven't gotten it all. I mean, but you know, but that, what you're saying though, yeah, exactly. The effort is there. The effort to, so they've named a residential college at Yale after Pauli Murray. There's efforts on UNC's campus to rename buildings. There's talk about some kind of statue in Baltimore. Our site, the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice, which is anchored by that childhood home, is now a National Historic Landmark. We're in the final process of renovating the interior of Pauli's childhood home and hope to open that site to the public as people can actually go places, given what's going on in the world with COVID right now. But I think that why now, right? What's happening now? When could I have imagined people in the North Carolina state legislature discussing the pros and cons of critical race theory? When could I have imagined that most high school students have heard of intersectionality? When could I have imagined that queer people could be married and that trans folk could have the right to use the public facilities that match who they are in the world? The world is, some of those things happen slowly, some of those things happen more quickly. The world is finally beginning to take shape as that place where a Pauli Murray could and should be more valued. So the story of Pauli Murray, what's really great is when we do public programs and it happens online and it happens in person, all these different people show up because they connect to Pauli's story in different ways. They might be a lawyer. They might be a divinity school student. They might be an Episcopalian. They might be a poet. They might be a person who identified as gender nonconforming or trans. They might be from Durham. I mean, there's so many ways that people can connect to Pauli's story. And then they are like, they look around and they're like, wow, there's a lot of different people here. I think that this notion that it's important to know about, lift up, listen to, and respect people who have historically been so marginalized, so invisible, so threatened. And not that that's not still happening. Obviously, we're seeing that in terms of state-sponsored violence, and we're seeing that with the police. We're seeing that those oppressions that were part of Pauli's life have certainly not gone away. But we're seeing a lot more interest and a lot more willingness to expand the number of voices, the number of people at the table. And I think because of that, when you find out about Pauli Murray and you think about how could this one person have done all of these things in their life? Like, did they ever sleep? We wonder too. You know, you say to yourself, this is the reminder that we are not being taught the whole story. This is my favorite quote from Pauli Murray. And I think of this as a transformational quote in my life. It changed the direction of my work about 15 years ago. It's from Proud Shoes. It's not the topic sentence of the paragraph. But it reads, it had taken me almost a lifetime to discover the true emancipation lies in the acceptance of the whole past, in deriving strength from all my roots, in facing up to the degradation as well as the dignity of my ancestors. So I think about that as this transformational quote because Pauli Murray's family had both people who owned slaves and people who were born in slavery. People who are white, people who are Black, people who are rich, people who are poor, people who had Northern roots and Southern roots. And that call to not turn my back on that, to look for the whole truth, the whole past. I feel like that call to reckon with the degradation and dignity of my ancestors is so on time. It's so much where we are right now. It's the call to action right now, to know ourselves, to know our past, and to think about our responsibility to our past, because that until we do that work, all of us, we will not move to the future. And we all know that, and Pauli Murray knew that that past was full of pain and trauma and joy and connection and love and difficulty and being able to hold all of that. It's, you know, I was just writing this morning about Pauli and the idea of wholeness, and Pauli refers to something, refers to looking at their own mix of personalities and refers to it as riding wild horses. That the challenge of an integrated body, mind, and spirit is a lifelong pursuit. That is the kind of inspiration that I think makes Pauli Murray so relevant today. Those words spoken and written in the 1950s, in part as an answer to McCarthyism, as part of a way to lift up that if we want to understand democracy, we need to look at the history of African-American families. If there could be democratic activists among Black people who had been so degraded and so disadvantaged by the system and still held on to the concept of the promise of democracy, there was a lot to learn in that. Those teachings from Pauli, those messages, those are what I think make Pauli Murray relevant. And like you had shared, Zakiya, once people learn about Pauli, we joke about this. We're like, welcome to the Church of Pauli Murray. Now Yes. Your job is to go be a great missionary and tell 10 more people, right?
Yes. I'm converted. I'm listening great. To that quote was beautiful. Thank you.
It was.
Thank you for sharing.
It's on page 62 in case you need it.
Yes. Wonderful. Yes. Yes. Wonderful. Well, I'm going to do a little stretch here. That was very feeling so inspired. We're going to move into the lightning round, which is just our way of getting to know Pauli in a more modern day context, if you will. So our first lightning round question is, which work of Pauli's would make the best modern movie or TV adaptation, do you think?
Well, I think Proud Shoes would make a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's very dramatic moments in it. It's amazing. I also think that in a short form, there's an essay that Pauli wrote called An American Credo that's sort of a personal mission statement. Mm. Very powerful language written in the 1940s that would make a great like short play or short video.
Cool. It's
full of, just really powerful language.
I feel like an audible short or something like that, you know. We'll have to work on getting that going right away.
Yes.
Paperback, hardcover, or audiobook, which would be Pauli's preferred method of reading?
I have to say hardcover. We learned that Pauli lived at 50 addresses in their life. And yet carted around this huge library of books everywhere. I think really prized books, really prized reading from books, really prized writing books. Now, I don't know what they would do in an audiobook. Listening is a powerful thing. So perhaps it would depend. Books would definitely be the hardcover.
Okay.
But maybe there would be some lighter reading that would be more fun to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, which, if any, form of social media would Pauli prefer? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Well, I have always believed Pauli would be an amazing blogger because sermons are short, that sort of powerful punch of this is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to think that Pauli would be actually be on Twitter, that, quick turn of phrase, that powerful language. I think Twitter is the one that's leans most toward words versus images.
Right.
So I think Pauli would be a tweeter.
Right. And always in touch with what's going on, what everyone's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. What would she most likely have taken up as a quarantine pastime? Sourdough bread, knitting, a new language, puzzles, or something else?
Yeah. What would Pauli do in her spare time?
Stay still.
Yeah. So I understand that Pauli liked mystery novels. Pauli also always had a dog. always. So maybe they would be taking the long walks with the dog that you couldn't do if you were having to go to work every day. But right. I really think that, you know, puzzles might have also been something, crosswords, that mm-hmm. kind of thing might also been a big appeal.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that. That was wonderful. And thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my great pleasure to be with you and to share Pauli Murray and the Pauli Murray Center with your audience. We hope that you'll all come and visit us in Durham yes. as we move toward being a fully visitor-ready site and celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2022. So please visit us and visit us online, paulimurraycenter.com.